Now here we are back for our final interview of the Sports Medicine Update. We're at Memorial Hermann. I'm Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. We're talking with Dr. Rihal Vajani. All right, and this is one of Dr. Yellen's favorite people. He's been talking about this interview all day yesterday and today. I can't wait to get Dr. Vajani in here. The first person I heard Dr. Vajani live for was Yellen, so they got something going on.
We have a love for each other.
So. Yeah, it might be pathological at some point.
It's okay, don't worry. Don't worry.
So you talked today about theories on sickle cell and rhabdomyolysis. So if you will just give us a brief overview of your lecture today.
So, yeah, today is just, I wanted to touch base on, you know, NCAA changed the rules on sickle cell trait and the diagnosis and going through the conflicts and the arguments for and against doing the sickle cell training. And then, of course, sickle cell can lead to exertion or rhabdo, so that would be a perfect good time, midsummer, 100 degrees heat, 90% humidity, kind of go through some of the parameters with regards to that, as well as, you know, diagnosis, etiology, and treatment to give a good refresher for all the trainers out there to make sure they know it's still out there, it's very real.
All right, so just a quick question. How often is sickle cell found in non-African-American?
It's extremely rare. Usually it's from the African-American lineage, and usually there's a crossover at some point, you know, generations back. I've not seen it in a non-sickle cell, a non-African-American person in almost 2 years.
Are there other ethnicities, backgrounds that are more prevalent to get that besides African Americans?
Some Europeans tend to get it, but usually it's mostly just African Americans that get it. It's one of those, you know, straightforward answers. There's no really ground, there's no bubble around it that you
and
can.
It's a lot more in male than female.
A lot more than male, yeah.
And why is that?
Genetic predisposition. We still haven't quite understood how it even occurs as far as the true molecular changes in the DNA as the patient is, you know, conceived, figure out why they end up getting a sickle cell trait versus disease, and why the trait itself manifests itself and results and changes in the human body. I mean, you would think, you know, most people carry traits all the time and never feel it. You just know you're carrying a beta thalassemia trait, for example, is another microcytic anemia, and you have no symptoms from it. But if you mix two beta thalassemia traits and you put them to beta thalassemia, you end up getting a bone marrow transplant. So why sickle cell? Why does it manifest itself in an athlete? We still don't quite understand it. We don't understand what the changes are that weaken the cell to make it allow it to show itself in athletes. Normal population, walk around, no problems.
It's when that exertion starts and it leads to this cascade effect.
Right. It's all about the exertion. It's about depriving the body of oxygen that is normally there at rest and pushing your body to a limit where maybe the oxygen supply cannot be met. So everyone's different, right? Some, well, most trained endurance athletes that know how to adjust their body mechanics and have adapted in the right manner. Maybe sickle cellers and pro athletes, pro football players. You know, I had a question come in from Brad Brown, who was a former trainer in the NFL. Their sickle cell trait athletes stay all the time. Do they get sickle cell crisis, sickle cell issues? No, because they've been trained and their bodies have been trained so that their oxygen levels stay elevated regardless of their exertion. So there's a component of adaptation, natural body habitus, as well as training that play a role in how well, how quickly these exertions come about.
And so for the athletic training community that's in the high school setting, college setting, weekend warrior setting, what are some tips that you can give to them that, you know, obviously we're going to do some sort of testing, we're going to identify the trait or the disease, and what are some other pearls of wisdom that you can offer?
So, you know, like I said in my talk, I think the big thing is, you know, the worry from the American Society of Hematology is that this will be a discriminating factor to athletes, that you get diagnosed with sickle cell trait, you get treated differently. You'll get, the trainers will look out for you more. They may not push you as hard. The coaches may not push you as hard as a result of knowing that you have the trait. So I'm almost to the exact opposite. I think you treat it as a challenge. You have an athlete with a sickle cell trait. This is your ability to train this athlete even more and in a much more proper environment, in the proper setting with the proper strength and conditioning guys so that they don't sickle. Chances are if you put a normal person in that same regimen, they're going to get even better than they were before. It's just understanding training principles it becomes, and that's the biggest pearl I give is that, you know what, if you're a sickle cell trait athlete, you have no symptoms to this point, guess what, you're doing something better than the normal athlete's probably doing because you're not depriving your body of oxygen in a deficient state.
All right, so where do I find out about the proper ways to train them, like you just said, if I have a sickle cell athlete in my high school?
So that's a good question. There are not a lot of resources for sickle cell trait itself. There's not a lot of resources as far as online. It's going to take someone in a big city that understands the sickle cell trait itself, that understands the training principles. Fortunately for us at the Ironman, we have all the resources there that will allow us to, you know, if we have a college or pro athlete that's looking to go to the next level and we're concerned that they might have some limitation, we'll put them through all the rigors, the VO2 study, the nutritional consult, looking at their body mechanics and initial evaluation values, see if they're relatively depleted in electrolytes, and then work on a training regimen with our strength and conditioning guys like Rashad and Charlie to sit down and say, hey, look, we need to get this guy trained better, but it's going to be a lot more patience on your guys' part. You may not have the ability to go and push as hard or as fast, but we're going to get them there. The end road is still the same. It's just how you get there is a little different.
So it's not really something that I can do there at the school by myself, because I'd have to go through that testing, and then you need to go with somebody that is kind of specially trained in that.
So that, you know, you can do it. I think it's easy for the high school trainers to do it. It's just, it's going to be education. So, you know, the pearl I gave is that if you have a sickle cell trait athlete, they know their limits. By the time they hit the high school, they know what's going to set them off. Your goal is to move that threshold back. So, you know, adjusting their interval trainings, adjusting their reps and their maxes, giving them more time to recover, and allowing them to continue strength and conditioning camp, I think is extremely important for these guys. I think they need to be in strength and conditioning camp every year in the summer heat where it's in the worst conditions, and go through it in a much more relaxed setting versus when you're in training camp and you're in football season where it's all go, 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 and you don't have a chance to do any kind of off-season conditioning. I think the S&C camp and spring football play a huge role as, you know, taking dedicated time as a trainer to say, you know what, I know I can get this kid better. I know I can. I just need to be patient with him. I need to figure out where his limits are, and I need to push those limits to figure out how far can I go without making him set off.
And so let's go back to, right, you got sickle cell and, you know, this rhabdo condition. So let's say I have a sickle cell patient, you know, trait or disease, and I want to, you know, push that envelope. And, you know, nowadays you've got, you know, the big buzz on the street is, you know, this CrossFit, cross training, yeah, that kind of stuff. Tell me a little bit about your take on something like CrossFit, sickle cell trait, rhabdo.
So what we'll do is 2 out of 3. I'm going to take you a CrossFit and rhabdo first, and I'll throw the sickle cell trait in next. You know, what it, in the NCAA Sports Medicine Handbook 2014-2015 edition, which is the current edition, 10 factors that affect rhabdo. CrossFit fits half of them. You know, most people, when they go into CrossFit, when it first came out a few years back, was the layman population thinking this would be the new great workout. It's extremely intense. It's extremely physically active, and there are no breaks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you set yourself up for a lot of injuries, not even for, we're going to forget about medical issues. We're going to set yourself up a lot of injuries. And, yeah, there's been a handful of cases where easily documented that rhabdo was caused by that CrossFit regimen. Okay, and you throw the sickle cell trait on top. Now you're in a depleted state, you're weak, and you go into an activity like that when you haven't trained properly for it. Yeah, it's extremely harmful. Once again, you know, it's all about getting to CrossFit. I consider CrossFit a very elite activity and a very elite workout. There are people that go out there that can do it, and they, you know, they say, well, we're CrossFitters, and we go out there 3 or 4 times a week, and you look at them like, no, you're not. It doesn't make sense. They do it because they do it to their tolerance. So that's the key. If you're doing it to your tolerance and you're trying to do the activities, great. That's the perfect way to do it. But a lot of times, walk in, and I'll do it. I'm going to be the classic example. Here's the guinea pig, patient zero. I walked into CrossFit pretty much in the best shape of my life, tore my hamstring 20 minutes into the workout. Was very flexible, had no problems, but it was a new workout for me. It wasn't something I had experienced. My muscles had not done that eccentric contraction and had not done that isometric stuff that I've done in a long time playing soccer and playing football. I was not ready for it. I went in there and I blew out my hamstring. It's a simple 20-minute thing. It can happen to anybody. The point is, I don't think CrossFit is an exclusion for sickle cell trait patients. I think, once again, getting into it in the right setting, with the right training, with the right setup, will do just fine. And I would encourage it, because once you get to that CrossFit level and you're doing it at the elite level, you've seen these professional athletes, these guys have some of the most endurance I've ever seen. They have some of the best strength I've ever seen. They're very pliable. They're very mobile. But here's the greatest thing. they can do all that and walk out and not have any problems. Unlike, you know, certain other sports where they walk out huffing and puffing and they're walking away and they're like, they're dead in the water. These guys come out and they're ready to go for the next round. So that's the key to the CrossFit.
And so, you know, in your experience, are there any nutritional factors? You know, a lot of people will talk about supplements. They'll talk about, you know, some of the latest diets like, you know, paleo diet.
Yeah.
Or, you know, talk a little bit more about supplements, diet. Does any of this help?
The question is, does it really? We don't know. We have no evidence supporting for Gantt. What we can tell you is that there are certain supplements that do tend to increase performance. We know that creatine can potentially increase performance. We know caffeine can increase performance in endurance athletes if you take it at the right time, at the right number, and everything else. If with all the other supplements, it's not known. We're still doing a ton of research. We're still trying to figure it out. I know, you know, there's new supplements like the Shreds. You know, the big one is now Shreds. That's all over online, all over Instagram. Everyone's talking about Shreds, how it just shreds their body fat in within 6 weeks. And you're good. It's a fat burner. It's a great fat burner. Question is that the right thing to do? We don't have the answer for that. Well, it's going to take us 20 years to where these athletes or these people that are taking these supplements to see the long-term ramifications, if it's worth having them on or not. It took us 20 years to realize what creatine does to you, mm-hmm. right? Because we've had creatine since the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's been out there. We just thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And then we realized it was the worst thing since sliced bread. And now we're realizing there's a happy medium, right? Same thing with whey protein. It took us years to figure out that whey protein is actually very easily dissolvable, and it's very healthy. Now, 10 years from now, I'm going to be sitting here looking like a fool probably because whey protein might have something bad to it. What I will say is with all the diets, and this is the key thing, you know, with this, with the sickle cell and I think with any population, if you're going on a diet, and when I mean diet, you're picking a regimen that's going to be a temporary change in your eating habits and then supplementing it with a high-intense workout, probably not the best thing in the world. It isn't. You know, I always encourage patients when I do my weight loss and we talk about fitness, we pick one first. We fix that one first before we change the other one. Give your body enough time to adapt. Don't try to go in there and say, you know what, I'm going to change XYZ my diet, and then I'm going to go work out 4 times a week. Your failure rate is greater than 70% according to statistics when you do something like that. Mm-hmm. For a sickle cell person, even more because of the fact that it's going to push you into that crisis. So I'd say slow, pace yourself, and get to where you need to get.
So if nutrition could help, it would probably be indirect.
Correct. It's indirect. What we talked about, sickle cell, when they start going into the, I wouldn't call it sickle cell crisis, but when they start, quote unquote, sickling from as a trait, potassium drops. Red blood cells become hypoxic. They get dehydrated. These are certain things that you can easily fix, and you can potentially improve your chances of not going down that far by just, you know, maintaining a well-balanced diet, making sure you're getting your carbs and protein in before your workouts, making sure you're getting in within the first 90 minutes. Now there's some data that says even 6 hours afterwards is still appropriate. Making sure that you've weighed yourself before and after, looking at, it's your only objective measure. You have two objective measures for hydration. You have your pre and post weights, and you have your urine color, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Thirst is 4.5% dehydrated. You already passed the slippery slope at that point, so you can't use that. So I'd say using what you know, and what we know now is limited, using what we know to get us to the point where you need to get. So nutrition is indirect, but it's also very much as direct as far as maintaining current homeostasis and not allowing things to happen when we push our bodies.
Have you seen the prevalence of sickle cell trait or even the disease shift during the years, increase, decrease, anything?
So the shift is always up, right? And the shift is always up because now we're testing for it. In the NCAA, we're testing for it. So now obviously the number of incidents, number of prevalence in sickle cell trait has gone up. Is that an absolute up? I don't think so. It's a relative up. Same thing like we did with concussions, right? As soon as we started diagnosing concussions and realizing how bad it went up.
We're able to identify it better.
So is the rate going up? I don't think so. I think the rate is staying level because nothing's changed. I don't think sickle cell trait patients... I think the key thing now is that they're realizing that they're traits, so they don't, you know, trait with trait won't marry together and cause an increased risk for sickle cell crisis, sickle cell disease. So I think the rates actually might be slightly going up, but we won't never know. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet. When we get to genetics and we get to genetic medicine and we're starting to understand how everything works and we can walk around and say, look, here's my arm, take the blood, and you know everything about me in less than 30 seconds, when we get to that point, all these studies will become much more valuable to us, and then we'll have a good understanding of what we need to look for in the future.
Yeah, until now, it's just all speculation.
It's all speculation.
It kind of makes you think, though, how important maybe a geneticist would be in sports medicine.
It is. It is. And, there are not a lot. I only know of two sports geneticists in the country, and both of them are just because a lot of pro athletes like going to them, and they just like to make sure they're okay. So it's one of those things where sports medicine is going to continue to evolve, and it's going to continue to bring in resources from medicine as a society that will be needed to be specialized in this particular group of people. It's different. We're athletes. We're different. It's just simple as that.
Very interesting. Any other questions for Dr. Bajani in this realm? I know Jeremy's been here for 2 days straight. Hasn't slept a wink.
No, I slept fine. It's been good. It's been... Today, I felt like it flowed even easier because, we had everything set up, and it was busier, but it was good because it kept people coming in. So.
That's great.
But I think that's about it for me in particular. But.
Nicole, you have any more questions for Dr. Bajani?
I might have one about rhabdo. So you were talking about cramping. Is there a specific section, muscle, area in the body that may indicate to you, okay, this could potentially be rhabdo more than just a muscle cramp?
Yeah, so... areas that are not weight-bearing, we always see it. Football players, what's the first thing they cramp? They cramp their calves. And then it's the quad right after, right? Mm-hmm. So the rhabdo is the areas that are not weight-bearing. My classic giveaway is I had that 16-year-old girl who rhabdoed because her arms hurt. And that's it. She played soccer, which is not an arm injury. Mm-hmm. She played soccer. She did a couple of push-ups, and mm-hmm. that's it. And she came in next day and said, Dr. Bajani, my arms ache like anything, and you looked at her arms and they were physically looked like Popeye arms.
Mm-hmm. What about bilateral versus...
So bilateral is another one, right? Bilateral, you don't cramp. You either cramp all over or you cramp in one spot. You don't cramp in both sides at the same spot. It just doesn't happen. It's certain patterns that you have to look for to make you tell you rhabdo. In addition, rhabdo causes the muscle not to look spasmed. It looks like the muscle is swollen. Mm. So that's the key difference, versus the muscle is completely normal in a sickle cell trait person that's not having an issue. So the feeling the muscle, getting a good exam on it will tell you, what's going on. It's where, we talk about this. You talk about this all the time in medicine. 90% of your diagnosis will come straight from the history. It will give it away.
Every physician that we've talked to, every clinician, athletic trainer, physical therapist, physician, whatever it is, that particular theme, know your anatomy, know your physiology, a good history, good observation, and you can figure out the diagnosis.
Right, and so that's why telemedicine is becoming so important, right? Mm-hmm. Because a good telemedicine doc, which we might end up going to, there's push for it. I should be able to sit here on the phone and I have Dr. Yellen or I have Nicole. You call me and say, I'm sitting at home and you can't get hold of your team doc or something happens. You call me and say, Dr. Bajani, hey, I've got this and this person. 90% of the time, I should be able to tell you the diagnosis based on what you tell me, which is what you was told by the athlete. And then the other 5%, I'll trust your physical exam without examining my patient. But that's the point. If you can't do that, that's a huge problem. That separates a lot of trainers from other trainers. That separates a lot of nurses from other nurses. It's that history taking. It's just taking the 3 extra minutes to sit there and talk to them and knowing which questions to ask and how to ask them in a way, and that's experience being built so you can get to the answer that you need. You can get a cold. And Jeremy, here's a classic example for you. You can get a cold, right? And I can see you right now and look like you might have a cold. But if you tell me a story that looks like sinusitis and that wants antibiotics right away versus a cold that doesn't want antibiotics, I should be able to tell that on a history. Nicole knows because I had taught that to her last week. There's key differences. But there's how many questions? 3 questions I taught you. 3 questions took 20 seconds, changed my treatment for you and your patient outcome as a result. That's key. It's the history. It gives everything that you need. The exam is supposed to support your history, not change your management.
So Dr. Bajani, what he's alluding to is that Dr. Bajani is our medical director for the Master of Athletic Training Program, and he's also an adjunct faculty for me, and he's teaching our Gen Med class. So our students, they get to interact with Dr. Bajani, comes in throughout the time of their curriculum, gives a few presentations, he teaches the Gen Med class for us, he's a preceptor for us. And so second-year students like Nicole are going to be able to get to rotate with Dr. Bajani at his clinic where they get to see patients and you know, these are all accreditation standards from the Katie, and he's a huge, a huge benefit to us. I think it's one of the things that separates us from other programs, to have a medical director that's so involved. Yeah. All right, well, if there's no other questions for the great golden child, Dr. Bajani.
You know, they love saying that word. I don't know what that means.
Dr. Bajani?
Yeah.
I love saying that word. Or the golden child.
The golden child.
The golden child.
The golden, the chosen one.
The chosen one.
Wow. I feel like Neo, the one, you know, it's like the Matrix is coming back. I'm just happy to be here. You know, like I said, it's been, I've done this podcast with you for 2 years now. And, you know, last year I was sitting here getting ready to teach. This year I'm sitting here actually teaching. It's just been a huge honor to interact with this training, you know, population. I love athletic trainers. I think that they are extenders. I said it last year on this podcast. I'm saying it again. They are extenders. In the world of sports medicine, you guys help us do what we need to do better. And so it's an honor to be able to teach you guys and hopefully learn from you guys as much as I teach you and keep growing this bond, because we're going to – guess what? Sports medicine is growing. It's not dying down.
It's not going anywhere.
It's accelerating at a much more – at a logistical curve. It's not linear anymore. Right. We got to get ready for it.
Well, on behalf of the Sports Medicine Broadcast
– you can't leave without saying the website, Josh.
If you're interested in the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston, go look us up at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT.
And on that page, would there be a link to your medical director?
There would be. As a matter of fact, if you look over to the left, you're going to see a number of different links: mission, vision, goals, curriculum, people. And if you click on the people, you're going to see faculty, and you'll see myself and Dr. Knobloch and Dr. Bajani. And Dr. Bajani, under that, will say MAT Program Medical Director / adjunct faculty / clinical preceptor
/
golden child. You get it.
Yeah, put Dr. Lane up. You know, we'll give Dr. Lane a shout out for that one.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Johnny. Thank you, Nicole, Jasmine. As always, great.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure. I'm Jeremy Jackson, host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast, and we are